This is Bam. He's the Batmobile. I don't know why he has confetti on him in the toy. I think I ordered, I think I got these at Target, which we're now boycotting. But so that's Bam. Bam? Yeah, Bam, short for the Batmobile. And then, yeah. Yeah, like I said, I don't know what the confetti is about. BB is the motorcycle of Batgirl. She's kind of spunky and rambunctious. Spunkbunctious? I don't know. That sounds bad. And then I don't think this comes from the comic books. Robin has a sports car called Red Bird.
Oh, yeah, he does.
So that's Robin's sports car.
That's and slick. Then
so there's bad guy talking cars called the Legion of Zoom. See, and this is the Joker's. The Joker has a minivan, which tracks, I think. That evil, yeah. If you're evil, you have a minivan.
It's kind of like Turtle Manny. Yeah.
Yeah. And then the Riddler has the Riddler copter. I don't think that's its name. But you have this sweet ass helicopter action right here. Look at that.
I would love to go through the next 10 or 12, but we have a guest waiting for us. So
oh, right.
Maybe we should.
Right.
Yeah.
Hello and welcome to the Writer's Block, season 5 of the 2-time Telly award-winning podcast. Coming at you today, like that extremely pretentious dude in the crew who loves to find a reason to quote Shakespeare. What a piece of work is man, Avalone. How noble in reason, how infinite in faculty, in form and moving, how express and admirable, in action, how like an angel, in apprehension, how like a god.
Yes, no, I am absolutely like that. God. I am, what you put a microphone on me and ask me for test 1, 2, 3, I will absolutely give you either to be or not to be for about 20 lines or the Gettysburg Address. Those are my go-to sound checks. Or when in the course of human events it becomes necessary, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
7 years ago.
I will say I only know the preamble. I only know the preamble to the Constitution because of Schoolhouse Rock. And I can't say it without saying, if you ask me to recite it, I will do we the people in order to form a more perfect union. Provide for the common.
My dog normally waits like, you know, at least 5 minutes to try and kick our way in, but that was right in the middle of the intro. We have not introduced ourselves yet. I am Ryland Grant, screenwriter, Ringo Award-winning creator of Vine Comics like Aberrant, Banjax, The Jump, and The Peacekeepers, which just wrapped up on Kickstarter. You can still grab it if you need to go over there and do that. The Other Voice in the Dark, if you are just listening, The Man in the Box to the left, if you are watching on our shiny Telly Award-winning YouTube channel is...
David Avalone, writer, coffee achiever.
Coffee achiever, love it. And if you missed any of our previous conversations, that is episodes featuring comic luminaries like David F. Walker, Matt Fraction, Stan Sakai, and Kevin Eastman. Our entire catalog can be celebrated via iTunes and other purveyors of worthwhile ear crack. It is all matriculating. It is all making its way onto our shiny new YouTube channel, so wait for it. Look at the back issue episodes that pop up every so often. Double on back and check all that out. We have a great show today. I'm very excited about this one. Do you have anything to pimp before we get into the interesting people?
I have things to pimp, actually.
Yeah.
I launched a Patreon. So find me on Patreon. I have many. From the free level to the $1, $3, $5, and $10, and $20 levels. There's all sorts of goodies you get for signing up and for sticking around. And it's also partly, it's just a place where everything I do on the internet is going to come together. And obviously I'll also be pimping out this show, on the Patreon. I did just discover that, Dynamite Entertainment, and I discovered this in the last 5 minutes, has finally made a deal with Lunar, which is why my, book Red Sonja Noir was not in stores yesterday as originally planned, but it will be in stores on July 16th, and I believe that to actually be true. Nope. So what do you got going on?
Like I said, the Peacekeepers just wrapped up on Kickstarter, but we are taking late pledges. You can still grab it. Half Evil Comics is about to go crazy. We haven't formally made our announcements, but a lot of stuff kind of in line for San Diego Comic Con. So just go over to the interwebs, the social meds, at Rylan Grant, at Half Evil Comics. Make sure you're watching that stuff because it is about to get funky. I'll leave it at that. More to come. I could tell you, but I'd have to kill you, all that good stuff. Extremely busy, wildly interesting. Let's bring the guests on. Stop jabbering.
Hey, ladies and gentlemen and ships at sea, I'd like you to welcome Michael Stern.
Thanks for having me.
Howdy, howdy.
Oh, our pleasure. Thanks for joining us. Before we went live, Mike was commenting that we all have extremely busy backgrounds since we're all in our offices. And I think that's a good thing. I like seeing what people have as their background on Zoom calls. It's interesting to me.
Question. What percentage of your viewership do you think would recognize this?
Oh, yeah.
Oh,
Indiana
nice.
Jones, right?
That's the headpiece of the staff of
Ra.
Yeah.
There you go.
80-90% of the people watching?
I think so. Maybe not 100% because there are going to be some people out there under the age of 30 who maybe have not memorized every moment of Raiders of the Lost Ark.
Yeah. These guys are pretty literate, but I'm going to go ahead and grab my
wow. I love
that. Nice.
My little idol, but yeah, you know, this is it's definitely the type that tunes in here. I mean, I think it was like the one positive thing that came of COVID was that we were all very private about our inner sanctums, and COVID made us, we had to retreat into our inner sanctums, and maybe we haven't come out enough yet. We did get into the habit of kind of inviting people in like this. So,
thing even about like politicians and news personalities. Like I know that Mark Elias has a large black dog he loves very much because almost isn't, you know, the famous, the Democratic lawyer who does such great work. His entire background is like pictures of the dog and the dog itself and a sculpture of the dog. And it's like, we get it, Mark, you dig your dog. And Amy Klobuchar always has some very good looking baked goods in her background. Ooh, wow. She's always in her kitchen. And my wife and I are like, so what's that in the cake tray? Is that appears to be a lemon bundt? You know, so like I watched the news to find out what Amy Klobuchar is serving for tea, apparently tomorrow. But anyway, let us get into our Mike. Tell the people at home a little bit about yourself.
Well, I'm Michael Stern. I'm an animation writer, show creator, showrunner. Currently showrunning Batwheels for Warner Brothers, which is on Netflix and Max.
Yes, Max, which is about to become HBO again, or is it about to become HBO Max again? I'm lost. I can't remember.
HBO Max, I think.
Okay, it's going back to HBO Max. I eagerly await the day they finally discover that they should call themselves Discover. That was a little joke there. They discover that they should call themselves Warner Brothers Plus, because that's at the end down this long road. I'm pretty sure that's what we're going to find eventually. But so in the interest of full disclosure of all the guests we've ever had on this show, I have known Michael Stern since 1977 in Churchill Junior High School in East Brunswick, New Jersey, which is one could even say a long time ago in a galaxy far, far away. Hmm. And the year being 1977, oh boy, guess what we bonded over? A little indie space movie called Star Wars. And that was the beginning of our very long friendship. Went to college together, have worked on a million things together over the years. And now I've written 5 episodes for Batwheels in seasons 2 and 3. Which was a great joy and a great pleasure. But Mike, you've had a fascinating career all of the things you've done before you were a showrunner in animation. And right out of college was West End Games, or what was between that?
Pretty close. I mean, I think the only thing that came before that was my first failed attempt at Hollywood.
Right.
Which was coming out here straight out of college, straight out of film school, and getting out here and being incredibly intimidated because you're working as a PA, you know, and all the shit is rolling downhill onto you. And, you know, every barber has a script under their barber chair, and every taxi driver has a script in the glove compartment. And you're thinking, what have I gotten myself into? You know, I'm so far away from what I imagined I'd be doing. So that's what got me to, you know, I sort of didn't stick it out the way you did it the first time. And I left within a year, went back east and sort of said, you know, how do I get closer to being creative, you know, and not just fetching coffee, and sort of reinvented myself as a writer then.
Mm-hmm. And then how did you get involved with West End?
Strictly by chance. I just answered an ad, and, you know, being, they had Star Wars, the role-playing game. So, you know, being a Star Wars fanatic, as you mentioned, I jumped at it and, you know, went to this interview and babbled about Star Wars, and they said, you're in. And I got this job just sort of writing the backgrounds and histories of, you know, the Cantina aliens and the Rebel pilots and all these things. And at the time, you know, the last Star Wars thing that had happened was 83. It was Jedi. And
right.
Prequels were not even thought of yet.
Yeah, and the comic had gone out of print in 86, 87.
This was right after that. So this was 89, 90, something like that, or 88. And there wasn't a whole lot of going on. Maybe some novels, and there was the games, the role-playing games. So we, you know, created a lot of this stuff. We filled in the blanks that George Lucas had left, is the way I put it. And filled in everything from, like, what is the history of the Millennium Falcon to, you know, what are the names of these guys? And, you know, like the Cantina aliens were all called, you know, Snaggletooth and Walrus Man. And, you know, that wasn't good enough for role playing. So we had to, you know, come up with all this stuff. It was a great deal of fun. And I recall getting you involved, and you did a great job of writing some of that.
Well, thank you. So, yeah. I was writing a paranoia book for the paranoia game, and the contract was okay, but the upfront money was hilariously low. I think it was like $400 or something. And I called you up and said, I don't think I can survive to finish writing this book. And you just throw me a little something that I can work on fast. And you said, well, I'm 5 pages short on Star Wars Galaxy Guide 5, Return of the Jedi. Come up with 5 pages of short story material on stuff that happens off screen in Jedi. And I wrote 4 stories, 3 one-pagers and 1 two-pager. And the two-pager, ironically, got turned into an action figure set and a pop-up book, which I always thought was hilarious. But much like that, even though all of our stuff kind of got knocked out of canon for a minute when Disney bought it, what kind of amusingly happened is, even though it was out of canon, when Dave Filoni or Jon Favreau needs to look up the name of a character, who needs to look up General Madine's first name, or what is the Snaggletooth alien really called, or what is the one I remember you telling me about, what is the official catalog designation of the Millennium Falcon? That's you. That's all stuff you came up with. If I remember correctly, there was a later writer who came up with the Gorman Massacre, which also comes from the game, and got you. Was sure. The whole topic of season 2 of Andor was something from the Star Wars role-playing game.
We've seen a lot of that stuff pop up. You know, the first thing, not a lot of people remember this, the first thing I remember seeing it pop up in was they gave all of our stuff to Timothy Zahn.
Oh, he right.
Working his novels, because he's like, okay, I've been hired to do this. You know, what do you have for me? And they said, well, this is what we have. So that we were being used as kind of the official source book at the time. So stuff started popping up in the Timothy Zahn trilogy, which was fun. And then, you know, we've seen it pop up on screen all over the place now.
Yeah.
You know, the various things that we just pulled out of our rear ends out of thin air, you know, have popped up. So it's fun. It's a great deal of fun to see all that stuff. We don't see a dime from it, of course. You don't own that.
Of course.
But it's fun to see that it gets used and is somehow gotten through the filters and stays canon in some sort of way. Yeah. So
yeah, like your big ally here is laziness. It is easy for them to look up what did Mike Stern call this thing in 1989 than it is for them to go, let's think of a new name for the Snaggletooth alien or the Hammerhead alien.
Well, I mean, it's part of the machine, right? Where it's like, yeah. I mean, the fans are so militant and on it that if you try and call the Snaggletooth alien something else, they're going to be like, no, actually, and then they're going to pull that out. They're going to weaponize it against you. But it also, I mean, it's a way of rewarding fans, right? It's like somebody who celebrates the entire catalog. Like, you know, I mean, I love it. I mean, I'm a huge, you know, huge Karate Kid guy. And a lot of people could watch Cobra Kai. And, you know, Cobra Kai worked on its own, but every episode had, you know, 24 Easter eggs in it. And I would catch them all. And every time I caught one, there was this thing activated inside of me that you know, it gave me this warm and fuzzy feeling, took me back to 1985 or whatever. And Star Wars fans are like, you know, they are at once the best of that and the worst of that, right? You get something wrong. And they're going to make you feel it, even if it seems insignificant. But when you reward them like that, they're gonna love you for it, and they're gonna celebrate it, and they're gonna light up Twitter or whatever.
Yep, I couldn't agree more. I mean, I frozen in time. I'll never forget being at a con. I think it might have been Comic Con. Right after all this came out. When at the time, Comic Con was a different beast back then. Yeah. But I remember being there with West End Games, and we had the map of the cantina from Star Wars up there, and you know, a Star Wars fan was arguing with me that no, this booth would be over here. You kind of got this wrong. And I said, well, they sent us the blueprints of the set. You know, we sort of based it on the blueprints of the set. You know,
yeah.
They just wouldn't believe me. Like, no, I'm telling you, this booth is there.
Yeah. Anyway. Now that is one of the funnier things is the, you know, the arguing with the person who actually knows. And that is a phenomenon that's incredibly, there's a comic book writer, a friend of mine named Gail Simone, who I couldn't do what she does, but she baits guys like that. She will literally say the X-Men are great. Why have they never made any movies out of them? Just to make 1,000 neckbeards go, what are you talking about? They're great X-Men movies. And it's just like, you know, she's worked on the X-Men, you know, like it's not a, you know, it's I think it came from she had an experience where someone on a line to see the movie Deadpool was arguing with her that she didn't understand Deadpool. And of course, she wrote Deadpool and her name is even said out loud in the Deadpool movie as a hat tip to her. It's something like, you know, it's at the corner of Gail and Simone or something like that. I can't remember what the call out is, but she loves that. That would stress me out. I could never. Ignite that. I could never light that fuse with joy the way she does, but it does crack her up, and it cracks. You get a lot of people when someone melts down. A lot of people respond with the James Franco Coen Brothers gif of first time. you haven't seen this before, huh? So you were back east. You were writing for West End Games for a while, and. There's a huge leap between that and being in Los Angeles, show running shows for Disney and for Warner Brothers. And how did you make that leap?
I just, you know, West End Games was fun. They moved it from New York City to Honesdale, Pennsylvania, across the street from a cow pasture. And I just, as a young man, I just said, what happened to my life? So I really had Hollywood always in my mind and thought, you know, this is great, but it's not getting me any closer to that. So I did something you probably couldn't do today. I moved back to New Jersey and I went to the library and I got a book of agents, literary agents, all based in New York City. Cause I'm like, okay, I'm over on the East Coast. It'll be New York. And so based on that, on the names and addresses I got out of that, I wrote a letter saying, you know, hey, I'm this is the kind of fun stuff that I write, you know, very clever letter. Here I am. I'm a writer, a new writer. And I included a self-addressed stamped postcard that said, you know, will you agree to read something that I sent you? Yes or no? Made it as easy as I possibly could. And I sent 50 of these letters and I got back 49 no's. I got one yes. And that is still my agent to this day, almost 30 years later.
Wow. And she's still in New York.
She's still in New York. Wonderful. We're like family now. It's been a long time. She's amazing. Thankfully, she loved the script that I sent her. I mean, that was the lesson from that was when you do get a crack in the door, when you do get an opening, you have to nail it.
Yeah.
So fortunately, she loved what I sent her. And I started doing the other fortunate thing. I started out doing features for grownups and was doing okay. I was having scripts optioned and I had some stuff bought. And I'm like, this is great. I'm being a paid writer. But nothing ever made it to the screen. It was very frustrating. And she said, she knew I had young kids. She said, did you ever think of kids TV, kids animation? Because I have a lot of context there. And I thought, oh, you know, I could marry these two things I love, you know, and it sort of clicked in my head. And I said, that would be great. So she sort of got me an audition with another client of hers who was a showrunner on a show. And he loved what I pitched. So I got to do, I started doing just kind of moonlighting, doing scripts for Disney on their young kids shows, nights and weekends while I worked a day job at IBM. And it was great. It was fine. I was enjoying it. And I thought, okay, you know, I'll see what I can make of this New York thing. But as you know, from someone in LA at that time, you know, New York is much more limited. It's much more of a silo than LA. And so I never really got much of anywhere until they called me, Disney, and they said, hey, you know, we love what you've been doing. And we have this show, a live action show. We'd love for you to be on the writing staff. Would you come out to LA and be on the writing staff? And I had kids in school and I said, you know, I just got cold feet. I said, I can't really do that. I can't pull my kids out of school and pull up stakes. And so I said, no. And about a week later, I got laid off from my IBM job along with like 500 other people. It was right at the height of when everything collapsed, 2009.
Right.
So that was like the universe saying, okay, go be a writer. You know, so I called them back at Disney and I said, I'll take it. And I went out there, you know, on my own, left the kids back east with my wife, my then wife, and, you know, did a season there and absolutely loved it and sort of said, you got to come, you know, y'all got to come. And so they joined me and luckily I've been working steadily since then. But it's funny because I always call myself like a positive recession story. You know, if there hadn't been a recession then, if I hadn't been laid off, you know, I never would have had the career that I have now because I didn't have the intestinal fortitude to pick up stakes and move to LA, something you did and stuck with.
Well, I did not have a wife and kids, which makes it much, much, much easier. And, you know, it's so much easier to take that risk for yourself than take it for other people. But it's, you know, it's one of those funny things. For whatever reason, I remember where I was and what I was doing when you called me and said, I'm moving to Los Angeles. I was in the parking lot of Three of Clubs on Vine Street in Hollywood. And I was just very happy that you were coming out here and thought it would be great for you and great for the rest of the family and all that. And what was the first show that you worked on?
The very first show that I freelanced on was called Handy Manny for Disney. But that writing staff job was a live action show called Imagination Movers about a band. Right. And that was great. It was a super fun show. Actually, when I came, it hadn't been officially greenlit. So it was really, was a little bit of a risk, but kind of like a jump in the net will be there kind of situation. You know, you have to believe in it. And, when I got there, Disney has been amazing. They just sort of brought me up through the ranks, you know, freelance writer, staff writer, then story editor, head writer, showrunner, you know, like they just kept, you know, nurturing me through it. I owe a lot. I came up through that Disney system.
Do you think that system still exists at Disney? What's your confidence in level that someone's really starting out now would have?
That's a really good question. I'm not sure that it does. I think it's more lateral moves now, you know, because there's a lot of turnover. There's a lot of turnover of executives and, you know, it's not one thing in place. You know, you get those people who champion you, who love you and you sort of, they're the ones who help you go through. And I've always tried to help everybody else because people sure. helped me. So I've always turned around and tried to, you know, help and get as many scripts for people as I possibly could too, because you just, you know, that's how you pay it forward. Kind of, you can't.
You have definitely been there for me with that. You have gotten me a lot of work over the years. And I've always appreciated it when you've been in a position to do so. And what was the show you were, what was the last show you were show running at Disney?
I started out, I was put in charge of a show called Sophia the First, which was a huge popular princess show. So my inner princess was coming out.
I have an 8-year old who loves it. Yeah. So
it was a great show. One of the favorites I've ever done. Then I took over the last season of Doc McStuffins, which was another super huge popular show. So
she loves really, that one too.
Yeah, just like
all the hits.
In my bones, learned how to show run on those shows, basically under great, great showrunners, you know, who knew what they were doing and really just mentored me. Very, very lucky to have all that. Then, you know, switched out at Disney, did some other things. You know, did more for them. I did Chuggington. I ran a show for them, which was great. And then, you know, got Batwheels from Warner Brothers, which was like a dream, being able to do, you know, a nerd project that made my inner nerd happy.
Now on Batwheels, they didn't come to you and say, make us a show about talking cars. They came to you and said, Batman Kids show, or what was the remit?
They said, look, I mean, basically the problem, they had never been able to crack Batman and superheroes for young kids. And they said, we've been having trouble with this. Would you take a look at it? And I looked at it and pretty much could see what the problem was right away, because when they do this kind of thing, you know, they dumb it down and they make it, you know, kidified versions of Batman with big heads and big eyes. And, you know, it's like, they're not falling in love with Batman because you've never showed them Batman. Right. You know, like, how would you expect them to fall in love with it? You're just showing them some kidified thing that sounds and looks like every other kidified thing. So, you know, the first decision was like, keep Batman, Batman, you know, I call it, instead of preschool, I called it pre-cool, you know, like we got Ethan Hawke to give it that legitimacy. And my idea was, he's a legit Batman. He does everything Batman does, short of punching people in the face. You know, he's a detective. He does, you know, his cool moves are still there, all his cool gadgets, everything, his attitude. And then, you know, we created the characters that the kids can kind of see the world through, the Batwheels, you know, and that's an important element for young kids, so they can relate to it. But they still had this, you know, legit Batman and Batman world for the kids to really get intrigued by, you know. So that was my idea, was this is going to play different than other things like Spidey and His Amazing Friends and whatnot, you know, where it's like, all right, we're saving the local lemonade stand or whatever. You know, this was more like, no, this is legit. Nothing against those shows, by the way. They do a tremendous job, and I know people who work on them. The idea of this one was different. Like, we're going to make it bigger tent. It's going to appeal. It's going to work for young kids, older siblings, you know, their parents, Batman fans. It's going to be more of a big tent kind of thing. And I was kind of like a, you'll thank me later, you know, and I think they saw that it was a bigger audience, you know, broader audience than they had ever originally conceived.
Yeah. I mean, I think, you know, like with Spider-Man, for example, there's sort of a built-in thing that he's a kid, you know? Yeah. He's not five-year-old, but he's in school, which kids, even someone in grade school can relate to a kid in high school. Like, they still know what school is like. They still have a crush on a girl. Batman is such a more remote adult weird thing to try to get. No, so there's this vigilante. Like, it's already a tough sell.
His parents were shot in an alley.
Which of course we never discuss on Batwheels. Just like we don't talk a lot about what happened to Mr. Brady and the former Mrs. Brady, you know, like what happened to those? Why are they single? We're not talking about why they're single, man. It's horrible. It's a horrible
story. It's not like there's never been more young, accessible versions of Batman.
Sure.
There's been plenty. So, like, you know, going back to the 66 show, and, you know, I spent my youth running around with a towel tied around my neck, you know, being Batman, like, that worked on multiple levels, you know. Then when you get to college, you're like, this is hilarious. You loved it for entirely different reasons, right?
And I believe in, was it Halloween of 84, you and I actually went as Batman and Robin.
Indeed. This did happen.
Am I glad?
Who was Batman?
I was Batman. Mike was Robin.
Wow.
I do have to, like, that's like, am I glad there were no cameras or am I sad? Like, I don't have a strong opinion anyway. It's probably for the best that those photos don't exist. But
Dave Abbo in tights, you know, it's probably records.
God, did I have tights on?
I can't really remember.
I kept the sweater and the cowl for a really long time.
I don't know that I've ever seen you out of a suit.
Yeah. Now it's all Jim Gordon. Now it's all Jim Gordon all the time. But the point of this is,
I view Batwheels the same way. You can have your cake and eat it too. You can play for young kids and for their parents and Batman fans too. You know, there's a lot to love about Batwheels for, you know, grown up Batman lovers. We put Easter eggs all over it, especially when we hired David Avalone to do some scripts.
I do love that the first thing we ever did together on Batwheels is we collaborated to make sure my dirty joke about Black Canary got in.
Amazing.
that was really like our first real discussion after I handed in a script. I put in a reference to Black Canary. Green Arrow's plane, who's also alive, is asked, where is Green Arrow? And the initial line was something like, oh, he's playing with his pet canary. And Warner Brothers kicked that back, and you reached out to me and said, I want 12 variations of that joke. We will find the one that gets past everyone. And I think it was like it settled on he's on vacation with his pet bird or something. It's not that different.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I think Warner Brothers executives didn't want a bunch of 5-year-olds Googling, you know, canary and finding the blonde lady in the fishnets. I think they might have been trying to avoid that problem.
We do kind of pride ourselves though on bringing things to a preschool show with Batman, bringing things that you wouldn't imagine, like Bane, Two-Face, mm-hmm. like Scarecrow, things that seem like they'd be incredibly frightening. Just finding, it's been a fun challenge, just kind of finding a fun way in to those characters and having it work for kids.
And
be a kick for grown-ups, seeing how we did that, how we managed to work that out.
Yeah.
Go
ahead.
I was just going to say, I love the spirit of experimentation. I love that. Batman has, you know, people have written a few Batman stories over the years. Right. And they all, you know, 90% of them kind of, you know, I don't know, just like melt together. Right. You know, you pick up the average Batman comic and it feels like every other Batman comic. And that's not to say that, I mean, some of the best stories ever told in comics have been Batman stories, and those stand out and above the other ones. But what I love about what you guys have done here is you have found different Batman stories and different ways to tell Batman stories. And it's almost like new Batman stories. So many Batman stories have been told, you know. That maybe sounds like a weird thing to say. Maybe I sound like, was it Hoover who tried to close the patent office because he thought everything had that would be invented had been invented? Maybe that's that sort of thing. But I think it's very interesting. I mean, I think it's like this minor miracle that you guys do every week where it's like, oh wow, this is new and this is exciting and this is challenging. And I do love, as the parent of an 8-year-old who has to watch a lot of this stuff, and not all of it, I'm not talking about the stuff you do, because again, like you mentioned some shows that my daughter watches religiously that I love. Sophia the First is great and fun and awesome. But on this show, you know, what I find when my daughter watches Batwheels, I will be doing something else. You know, whatever, I'm on the computer and I'm answering emails and she's got it on. And what I find is that my attention starts to get, there's a competition for my attention. And then at some point I have closed the computer and I'm engrossed watching a Batman story that I'm very excited about. And that I am glad is there are nods to me. And I think that is, there's so much art and so much love in that. And I appreciate it. So thank you for that.
Well, thank you. That's a very kind, and I appreciate that. It shows that it's, you know, it's kind of working, we're trying, because I've been that. I mean, the reason for this approach is I've been that guy on the couch next to my kids, you know, and I trying not to, you know, to hang in there through insipid things. And so I was determined not to make that this, to make this something that was very parent watchable, you know, and hearing this really, it does warm my heart. So thank you. Appreciate it.
Yeah. Well, and you know, and Mike, you and I are from the generation that grew up with the Bugs Bunny cartoons. And in my case, having someone around who was old enough to explain the references to the Depression and to failed presidential candidates of 1932, and you know, all the interesting stuff that comes out of Bugs Bunny's mouth. And those are absolutely, I always like to remind people, the feeling of Bugs Bunny cartoons comes from the fact that these are going to go before 1930s and 1940s Warner Brothers movies. And that audience, even if they brought their kids, you can't give them something saccharine and lame. Like, they're here to see Humphrey Bogart. They want, or Jimmy Cagney, or Errol Flynn. Like, they want Bugs Bunny. You know, they don't want Tom and Jerry. That's not what they're here for. So it's interesting, that idea of parent capture. Of the kid's going to see it more. It's going to be watched more times if the parents are also engaged with it. And one thing, you know, I know because we've talked about this, that you're an enemy of the Easter egg just for the sake of the Easter egg and the poking, the pressing the nostalgia button without a good reason to press the nostalgia button. And I think that's a good way to approach it, because there are shows that are just like a compendium of, Remember this? Didn't you love this? And it's like, give me something to actually care about. Give me Ryland, you were saying, you know, the question is always, should there be new Batman stories? And with everything, you know, I've said this a million times on this show, when you're given the assignment, you have to go, what's everybody else done? And how can I do something that isn't what everybody else did. I mean, I mentioned Red Sonja Noir before, and my entire impetus with that is I like sword and sorcery. I can write sword and sorcery, but partly it's, there are 1,000 issues of Red Sonja out there. Yeah. I haven't read them all, so I don't know what everyone else has done. You know what I'm sure no one else has done? Put her in the Maltese Falcon. I am 100% sure that no one has done that exact ridiculous thing. So that made it easy. That way I can do it and not go like, oh, did someone else write this Red Sonja story before? I have no idea, you know?
Well, I mean, it's all about the love and the respect that you're pouring into it. And, you know, a good story is a good story, but it was, I mean, we've kind of been through this. I don't know if I have boiled it all down, but when I got into comics, I had been writing in Hollywood for 12 years and had done some great stuff. And kind of like Michael was talking about, had written a lot of big movies that didn't get made and all that frustration, and got into comics to tell stories I couldn't tell in Hollywood, and was telling my stories and having a great time. And, you know, the comics by all accounts were pretty decent. So when that happens, people start coming to you and tapping you on the shoulder being like, hey, do you want to do this one shot? Do you want to do this character that's been around forever? And the answer in the beginning was almost always no. And part of it was bandwidth, you know, part of it was, well, you know, I was busy in film and TV, and which was a great thing. And, you know, only had this much bandwidth. And if I only had this much bandwidth, I wanted to tell my stories. But a lot of it was like, oh, well, you know, I don't know. I don't like that character. And, way too many stories have been told with that character. What new is there to mine? And, you know, it was just this kind of ignorance. I will say I was ignorant. And it wasn't, I've told you this before, Abalone, it wasn't until I looked at what you were doing with Elvira, because that was the thing I always had, was it was like, well, you know, well, what would I do with Elvira? Like, you know, I wouldn't want to tell an Elvira story, blah, blah, blah. And then I read what you were doing with Elvira, because I had asked myself the question, like, Abalone is one of the smartest guys I know.
Oh, I asked myself that question too. And I almost, if not for my wife wanting to meet Cassandra Peterson, I might not have taken the job. It was a combination of her and the artist, Dave Acosta, who loves Elvira. And he's like, I'm drawing this comic and you're writing it. And you don't get to say no. But yeah, like you say, Ryland, I really had to like dig deep and go, what the hell story do I tell with her? And the first thing I did was sort of throw out what had been done before.
And I read what you had done and where you took it and saw just the glee with which you were telling these stories. And I was like, I want a piece of this, you know, like I want to find out what my version of this is. And it's funny because it's like, it's weird because we're sitting here, Michael, and a lot of it has not been announced yet, but I have my own, you know, film and TV slowed down. So I have moved harder into the publishing and I have my own publishing company that's doing a lot of stuff, but the main next phase is a lot of licensed properties. We have acquired the rights to some licensed properties that I'm very excited about. We're still in the process of it. And so this entire new, you know, era of my company, of me as a writer, I owe to Avalone in a very weird way, because like I just couldn't boil it down. I couldn't figure it out. And then I'm like, oh wow, look what he's doing. And what is my version of that? And how do I make it? And so I went out and I found the properties that I wanted to play with. But I think that that's the thing. Again, a good story is a good story, you know, whether, if it's meant to be for 8-year-olds or whatever, like if you tell a great story for 8-year-olds, you know, his 35-year-old dad is going to watch it and be like, wow, that was a great story. Yeah, if you're having fun, yeah, go ahead.
Sure. I mean, you probably know this as a dad of an 8-year-old, like somewhere along the line, somebody decided that we have to protect kids from certain things. And one of those things that they don't do for, especially for young kids, is like very basic idea of making compelling stories. You know, it's not rocket science. Why don't they deserve to have compelling stories with plot twists? And when I did Batwheels, I said, I want to give kids the same sort of experience that we have, like when we go to a superhero movie or something, you know, what are we protecting them from? I even had post-credit scenes that I wrote for the first season. And it turned out that the people at Max couldn't do it technically, because when the credits come on, then they get really small. And, you know, so they couldn't make it happen. But I wrote them all in with the idea of, we're going to give them this experience. Like what exactly are we protecting kids from? Like, why not? Like, you've got to give them compelling stories. Otherwise it's just going to be forgotten tomorrow. You know, you have to give them a reason for like really investing and wanting to know how the story turns out. And then I try to throw in curveballs, you know, just crazy ideas, because the death of any show is when they start saying, oh, I could skip this one. You know, it's just another episode of whatever. So I try to keep them on their toes, because it might be that episode where this crazy thing happens. And, you know, I think that's another thing that, you know, it's been reserved for older people for whatever reason, you know, surprises, which I don't understand. You know, let's surprise and delight kids too. You know, it's just, I view it like it's just another genre, basically. And to Dave's credit, and a lot of the other writers who've been on this show, they view it that way too. You know, I always say this because I do get writers who come in from doing our dramas or sitcoms that are really well known, and they just kind of look down on it and they kind of half-ass it or whatever. And, you know, that upsets me, because to me, this is, you know, it's another genre. It's all about the characters and the same things that the things you've been writing are about. And to me, yeah, it's only like a cartoon about talking cars, but it's the Citizen Kane of talking car cartoon shows.
That's what you want to do.
Yeah.
And look, you've got an opportunity, anyhow, particularly an opportunity to talk to kids.
Yeah.
And to be any kind of straight or real with them, even in your talking car show. I have just heard about this the other day. I have not checked it out. My dad wrote something for Scholastic Books called Ed Noon's 5-Minute Mysteries. And there was these little like 2-page things where dad lays a, Ed Noon investigates a mystery, and you have to guess who the killer is, who stole the diamonds, who stole grandma's pearls, whatever. Books Amazing. Like, you know, slim little volume. Friend of mine contacts me yesterday and says, so I'm watching this 3-part, I think Netflix special on the hunt for Osama bin Laden. And the female CIA agent says she first wanted to be a CIA agent because she read Michael Avalone's Ed Noon's 5-Minute Mysteries. And they cut to a shot of the book, apparently. So wow. My father caught Osama bin Laden. I'd just like to point that out. But, you know, the craziness of that. And at my father's wake, celebration of life, whatever you want to call it. I put out a pile of his books and things. And a young woman who was a friend of my sister's was looking at the stuff and she gasped and she picked up that book and she showed it to me. And she said, when I was a little girl, I got this from Scholastic and it made me want to be a writer. And literally the first 100 things I wrote were 2-page mysteries for the reader to solve. I eventually moved off of that. But like that was your father's thing was my form. I was cutting a movie once back when I was in film editor, first editor movie I ever cut. And I was the writer director was someone I didn't know. And we were cutting in my living room because it was, you know, it was the current, the present Hollywood format. And he mentioned like, just to make conversation, I said, how long you been a writer? And he said, oh, since I was a little kid, I read this one book when I was a kid. And it was the first time I understood that a writer could have a voice and a point of view, no matter what they were writing. And I said, oh, what was the book? And he's like, oh, it's so silly. I don't even want to tell you. And I said, what was it? He said, it was the novelization of Beneath the Planet of the Apes. I swear to God, it's so well written. And I was like, go over to the shelf up in the A's. And he went, oh, you have it. And he went, oh, the guy has your name. Oh. But all of this to say, the stuff we read when we're a kid, the stuff, yeah, the media we consume when we're a kid, it teaches us everything about the world. You know, how many kids process loss for the first time over Bambi's mom?
Yeah, it was. Yeah, I mean, it was a silver bullet for me. I grew up in a housing project in Detroit, and it was very difficult. And the people around me were not great role models. And if I had taken all my lessons from them, from that place, I would, who knows where I would be? I would probably not be around anymore. And the TV raised me in a very real way. It was, I learned how to be a man. I learned right and wrong from Captain Picard. You know, TV was the only place where I saw like functional families and love and all of that stuff. And it started with DuckTales and Chippendale's Rescue Rangers and Goof Troop and Tailspin. And that was where it started, you know, and the idea that, well, you didn't have to stay where you were, you know, everybody I grew up with, they're still 5 minutes away from where they were born, you know, and they're going to live and, they were born, they're going to live and die there. And that's fine for them. It was not what I was supposed to do. And it was Uncle Scrooge and Huey, Dewey, and Louie being like, well, let's hop on a plane and go wherever we feel like and see where the day takes us. And that adventurous spirit is still in me. And it is wonderful to kind of see it in my 8-year-old, you know, see her like take to it the same way. And her situation is different than mine. It's better in a lot of ways. And she doesn't need it in the way that I needed it. It will not save her the way that it saved me, but it is still teaching her all of the things that she needs to know and be taught. And she can still go wherever she wants to go, like because of TV and cartoons.
I totally agree. I think TV is a much maligned babysitter. It's an easy target. Same as video games. If you have kids in this generation, another easy target to pick on. I think there are, as a parent, there are things you have to realize, you know, and as a show creator, there's an art form to getting your message through. You know, we pride ourselves on not like slamming kids between the eyes with a 2x4 with the messages that we have. We have Batman, we have Batmobiles, we have fun stuff going on, you know, and if the message gets through in kind of a tertiary way, you've been successful. If you're trying too hard, if you're lecturing, you know, it's not going to get through. No, you know, I've always thought of this show as, I don't want people to think of it as, oh, it's that preschool show with Batman. I like them to think of it as it's that Batmobile show. It's that cool Batmobile show. And mm-hmm. I think that I've heard that from people. And that makes me happy when I hear that, because it feels like, you know, the messages are going to be there. You know, I've done a lot of research in this area, and it's absolutely true that, you know, racism, that biases get formed very, very young. You know, and we do have a responsibility, but in order to make it work, you have to do it in a way where a kid doesn't feel like they're being lectured to, where it's just, you know, presentation. Representation is a really great approach. That's usually what I take I rarely ever do like a very special episode of Batwheels. Like that doesn't happen. But spoiler, you know, we have a character like Oracle coming in, which allows us to present like a differently abled character. Mm-hmm. Do I lean into it like it's, let's talk about disabilities? No, it's just, here's this really cool superhero who does these cool things, you know, and it's just showing that. We had it on Sophia mm-hmm. the First, we had a blind character. So, but instead of leaning into it like it was all about blindness, it was just, she's this cool Indiana Jones type archaeologist who can read the hieroglyphics on the wall of the tomb just like it was Braille, you know. And we got letters and emails from that community saying like, this is so cool, we've always wanted this kind of character, you know. You're not overdoing it, you're just showing, you know, cool people who are like this, you know. So I think the approach has to be, you know, not to lecture if you possibly mm-hmm. can't. You know, I couldn't agree with you more. I mean, I think the three of us, we were all partially raised by TV, and I'm certainly not afraid to admit that. You know, I feel like for better or for worse, it was a thing, and it formed us into who we are, and it did give us that kind of escape that we needed. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I mean, thank God, thank the universe for it. I mean, as far as I'm concerned, because I wouldn't have had it otherwise. So like,
yeah.
Yeah.
No, and I will say that, you know, the whole, my father had 17 brothers and sisters, which is insane. And it's clear to anyone who knew him, spoke to him, which Mike, you did, that he was not raised by his father or his mother or his family. He was raised by 1930s movies because that's where his brain was at peace. If you really think, like the two kinds of privacy he had was when he was writing, because just your brain in the paint, and when he was alone in a movie theater. And his morality and his ethics and his sense of justice and right and wrong. I'm Italian-American, as was my father. And it was a shock to me when I encountered Italian-Americans in my late teens for the first time who were racist, because my father very much was not. And these guys were using the N-word and being very, and I was like, hold up, aren't we, like, we're all on the same team, aren't we? We're all, you know, we all got the white man putting his foot on us. What are you talking about? Well, like, why would you even remotely think that they're the enemy? And it was shocking to me. But partly it's because my father did not get his education from guys on a street corner in the Bronx. He had movies telling him how to be about race and about, he never liked Gone with the Wind, you know, about fairness and freedom and liberty and equality and all of that. The movies were ultimately a better role model for him, a better educator for him in all of those ways than his friends and family and neighbors, and even I think school teachers would have been. He was also, and this is another thing that's underrated about movies and television, and he was an autodidact. He would go see the Ronald Coleman version of A Tale of Two Cities, which is what, 90 minutes long. And then he'd go to the library and take out the book and read 300 pages of Charles Dickens because he was now interested in it. Mm-hmm. And even though his schooling was pretty spotty, he learned everything he needed to do at the local public library, and he was inspired to do it by movies, by pulp magazines. You know, he would get interested in, and I saw this even when I was a little kid, like he would read a newspaper article or see a movie about a topic.
Yeah,
I'll just pick, you know, off the top, not that Titanic was the movie, but he would see a 1950s movie about the Titanic, and then he would read 8 books on the Titanic. Because, okay, now I'm interested in this. Now I'm going to read up on it. And I think that's, you know, culture should do that. Yeah. You should walk away from a movie about the Titanic, no disrespect to James Cameron, and go like, that was nice, but I'd like to spend a couple of days with a book on the Titanic and learn what it was really about. I'd like to dig deeper into this subject that you've now interested me in. And I think that's sort of the greatest gift you can give a kid, is make them interested curious. In the world, yep. Make them curious, mm-hmm. you know, and make them, you know, and that thing of, and you plant a joke in their mind that goes off 20 years later sometimes.
Yeah.
My favorite example of that is Boris Badenov from the Jay Ward cartoons, from Bullwinkle Moose. It just seems like a simple joke on a Russian name. Boris Badenov. He's bad. His name is Boris. He's a Russian spy. I think I was in my 30s when I came across the famous Russian opera, Boris Godunov. And I went, oh, that's what that joke was about. Like, that wasn't just, you know, a simple pun on Russian names. That was literally some writer in a writer's room went, Boris Godunov, Boris Badenov.
Well, you just described what most people who read your comics do.
Oh, thank you.
It hits them 2 weeks later, 2 years later. Oh, wait a minute. This is what this Easter egg meant.
The tricky thing is you just want to make sure that the thing works without that. Bat Wheels, mm-hmm. I think, works without getting any of the adult references. Mm-hmm. The time I most had a crisis of conscience, honestly, is I did the Elvira in the Shining issue. Thought it was the funniest thing I've ever written. It still might be the funniest thing ever. Sent it off to the publisher, you know, got it drawn and whatever. And then when it came out, I was like, if you haven't seen The Shining, this is the most incomprehensible 20 pages you will ever read in your life. But I mean, I think that may not be true. The jokes may work, even if you don't know The Shining, even if you don't know. I did this thing, you know, how when Jack Torrance loses his mind, he starts quoting TV and nursery rhymes. My version of that was he starts quoting Jack Nicholson movies. So he's chasing her around with the axe going, you make me want to be a better man, you know, and you can't handle the truth. Like all of the, and then when they get to the famous door scene, he cracks the door and says, did you ever dance with the devil in the pale moonlight? And she hits him in the head with a bat and says, you want to get nuts? Let's get nuts. But, you know, hopefully that's funny, even if you don't know that's Batman.
Well, certainly for kids, you know, it's easier because all you really have to do is have a really fun slapstick thing going on.
At the same time as, you know, exactly.
That might happen, and usually you have them. That is exactly. A rule. That, you know, I'll like you said, I'll never force it in. I'll never wedge it in there non-organically. You know, it has to still make sense and be fun in its own way.
Yeah.
Then it can be in there, but then it also
sometimes you do see a joke in a thing, and I'm just like, wow, they just worked so fucking hard to get that in here. Like the showrunner wanted this joke in the episode, and they had to build a fucking, you know, launch pad and a parapet to hold this thing up, and it was not worth the time and energy. But you know,
yep.
Hopefully you try to learn.
Hopefully you catch yourself doing that, which we often. As writers, like, hold on, what am I doing? You have to kill your babies sometimes, and those are usually the kind of babies that have to go, sadly.
Yeah, yeah. No, that's absolutely true. Batwheels 3 seasons,
mm-hmm.
correct? Will there be a fourth season?
Not really allowed to discuss this.
Okay, so, I didn't know. That's why I asked. I didn't know if it was an
official answer on that. You'll have to ask Warner Brothers.
Or Netflix.
Yep. You can ask in both places.
Yeah.
You know, I think it's the kind of thing that, you know, to get 3 seasons of anything is a huge accomplishment. So I think we're very lucky.
No, and because they're 12 minutes long, it's a lot of episodes.
Yeah. It's like, we did 120. I mean, it's a lot.
Wow.
It's a lot of Batman stories sure, no doubt. I mean, but the way DC put it to us and the way Warner Brothers put it to us when we started was, you're part of the multiverse. Like, you have the Batwheels verse, you know, you can take, you know, pieces of that and use it the way you need to. You know, we're going to approve it, we're going to make sure you don't do anything outside of the zone. And oh, by the way, you know, depending, there are certain heroes we don't want you to use because we're doing movies with them, things like that. That always happens. That it's a funny thing, and it happened a lot with Disney. You talked about Sophia the First. You know, they within these big companies, from looking from the outside, it looks like one big company, you know, one big happy company. But, you know, within it, there's people controlling different things. Like, I have control of the Disney princesses, and I have control of the streaming service, and you sort of have to work with everybody to make it work. It's not just like an automatic thing. It's always a battle. There's always a fight. Yeah. You know, with superheroes, they all have, you know, legacy estates that need to be, you know, involved, and they have, and DC has to come in and bless everything you're doing. And they've been great. They've generally loved everything we're doing. So we've never really had a huge problem with DC. In fact, they've been very complimentary. Sometimes we've done things and they've said, "Oh, that's a really great idea. Do you mind if we steal that?" You know, and say, "Go ahead, steal it for grown-ups." You know, so that's been a nice relationship. We'd have a few different advisors there, and you know, but that's, you know, different from the kind of notes you'll get from Warner Brothers. You know, everyone's got their lane.
Right. And you predate the James Gunn of it all, so he hasn't been involved in any way.
Not that I know of. Yeah, mm-hmm. James Gunn came in, you know, while we'd already been a going concern for a while. So I do know that. I interact with those. His show that he show runs, Creature Commandos, is on the same floor that we are in our building. And those guys are wonderful. They're all very complimentary of what we do, and what they do is amazing. So everyone at Warner Brothers, you know, artist-wise, is phenomenal. All the people who are doing there, with the people doing Harley Quinn, which is hilarious. And
yeah, I love that show.
Yeah, I mean, the Teen Titans people have been going on for years and years, forever. So I have a ton of respect for everybody doing. We were a new thing. Like, Warner's had not done shows for young kids. This was a brand new, scary thing for them. So I had to talk them into a lot of stuff. I had to talk them into music, into songs. Because they were like, "We can't have songs in a Batman show. That's ridiculous. We can't, you know, we're not turning this into a parody." I said, "Trust me, this is going to work great. You know, we're not going to have just," and again, this is like you were saying, Ryland, in a nod to parents who don't want to listen to Barney or anything like that. You know, we got an amazing songwriter, you know, who comes from a rock and roll background, and you know, we made these songs that are not just earworms, but great songs for anybody. I think we really convinced them to where now Warner Brothers is like, "Can we have more songs? Can we have more songs?"
So, yeah. Such a powerful tool when you get it right. I mean, I was walking around today and I have songs from the Descendants soundtrack in my head because they're good. You know, they're not all good, but some of them are really good and they stick with you. And I'm, you know, I'm at my karate dojo singing the Descendants song. You know, it's like that is a powerful thing. It's like you have reached someone, you have sort of touched someone, they have taken it with them out into the world. That's awesome.
One of the great thrills of my life was just walking my dog one day in Burbank and coming around the corner and hearing a kid singing one of the songs I wrote for Sophia the First. It was like probably more important than winning awards or, you know.
That stuff. I wrote a comic that's not quite for kids, but it's kind of a parody of things for kids, called The Radically Rearranged Ronin Ragdolls. And the artist on that lives up in Canada, and he did a local show in Canada, and some 11-year-old girl came up to his booth dressed as one of my characters. And I still think that was maybe the highlight of my career, that some 11-year-old girl in Canada went, "I want to dress as Tezuka from the Ragdolls." Like, you know, and this is without the support of a television show or a movie, or, you know, this is an indie comic that, you know, got read by maybe 15, 20,000 people, but it meant a lot to her. It, you know, and that's the, you know, the other comics journalist actually came up to me at a con recently and said that after interviewing me, he wrote his own comic because I had inspired him to do it. And I said to him, that is probably the nicest thing anyone could ever say to me about my work, is that it made you feel good enough about yourself to do your own thing.
Well, like it or not, we're influencing, you know, we are having influence on them. And I think it's can't be understated, you know, and it's a responsibility I take pretty seriously, because we see what's happening out there, and you know, they're young minds, it starts very early, like I said, and we need to make sure that, you know, they're seeing the right stuff. If they're being babysat by us, we have to be good babysitters.
Yeah. No, absolutely. I mean,
while at the same time having kick-ass Batmobiles and
yeah, Well, but then, you know, that always makes the, that makes the, you know, that's the spoonful of sugar, you know, that makes any medicine go down, as long as the balance is right. You know,
yeah.
I was saying, if you're telling a great story, the balance is always going to be right. Like, it's, they'll listen to what you have to say. I just watched, I have to say, as a quick aside, I hadn't seen it in years. Augusta and I decided to do the most painful double feature of all time. We watched The Brutalist, and then we watched The Fountainhead. So we had 5 hours of movies about architects.
Gary Cooper, yeah.
Yeah, Gary Cooper. And someone once said about The Fountainhead that it's the greatest anti-propaganda movie of all time. If you think Ayn Rand's ideas are stupid, holy shit, you should see them in that movie, because the movie makes it, makes them look as stupid as humanly possible. Not intentionally. It's unintentional. But the doctrine of selfishness that that movie tries to sell you, even Gary Cooper looks vaguely unconvinced the whole time by what he's having to say. And the writing is so, everybody, you know how bad writing is people's saying every single thing they think. This is like, they're not just saying every single thing they think. Everything they say has to do with their philosophy of life. Like, literally, if someone in The Fountainhead orders a sandwich, is like, I'm ordering a ham on rye, because ham on rye is the sandwich of people who do what they don't want and stand up for things. Just order the sandwich, man. Like, I didn't like, every line is a manifesto, and that makes the message they're selling seem so dumb. Like, it's, you should show it to anyone who's trying to make a message movie and go, this is what you should not do, because it's bad and it's terrible.
Message movie. It's really good.
Yeah. Yeah. But yeah, so you had a certain amount of freedom. How much did you find yourself referencing comic books or referencing Batman 66, or, you know, like, did you go back and reread anything, or, you know, you've been so immersed in Batman your whole life, you didn't really feel like you needed to?
No, I did. I did look at some things, and we tried to do some things that we, you know, I felt a little, I had to get exactly right. And because this is a sacred, beloved, Sam Register, the head of Warner Brothers Animation, said, this is a beloved character and you have to treat him with absolute delicate care. So I did take a look, and I made some tough calls, I mean, that have really paid off. So, for instance, we have what we think is the first African-American Robin ever presented. So there are kids growing up with Batwheels who their first Robin is African-American, which is huge, you know, and I've gotten this feedback before about how huge that is for them. But it was careful, you know, we were careful to select certain characters where things like this work. You know, we love to have the diversity as much as we can, but in an organic way. And really just ripping off of, I have to compliment Into the Spider-Verse, because I think they did this better than anyone. Just sort of, instead of replacing Peter Parker, they presented Miles Morales. They said, here's this other Spider-Man, but Peter Parker still exists. And oh, here's another one, Wednesday, and another. And oh, by the way, the theme is anyone can wear a mask. And so in that way, you don't insult anyone. You don't, you know, people who have loved these characters forever. So Robin was a character. There's been a few of these. There's been three or four, including a female Robin. So it's like, I did go back and look, and, you know, who could this be, and how could it work? And even though we never talk about the aliases on the show,
right,
I just made sure to pick, you know, certain things where, you know, the idea is we're not replacing anyone. It's just that right now, this is who's playing that role, you know, so it feels right for everybody. And like we've been very successful doing that throughout.
The Robin is from the comics, right? I'm not familiar with the name of the character.
Not officially. We never say it, so it doesn't really matter. So it's probably best not to bring it up here, because we never come out and say anyone's, you know, it was decided early on that, like, we're not even going to have Bruce Wayne, because, you know, the problems of a Playboy millionaire are not really important to a young kid, you know? So we never had Commissioner Gordon, you know, characters that, you know, felt like they wouldn't be sort of fun enough. Although I tried, As did you, as I recall.
Yes, I did pitch a Gordon story, and it got like two steps in, but it didn't get past two steps in. Mostly because I wanted to voice the character, but you know, that's we all try to do things that don't quite work. But yeah, I think the choice to go the secret identity thing is interesting because I feel like as a storytelling premise, it's sort of the oldest part of the Masked Avenger cliche. And I feel like the further we get down the road of history, it seems less and less relevant.
Yeah, and it's very confusing. You know, when you're trying to simplify things, that is very good. If you imagine trying to do a very clear adaptation, you know, like we always try to, like with the villains on that we're using, I try to pick a lane every time, like to make it really simple. Like, okay, Mr. Freeze, you know, we don't say that, like, you know, his wife died because he didn't find the cure of this, and that's why he's miserable. We just say he's miserable all the time. And so he wants to make you and everyone else in Gotham as miserable as possible. Or, you know, like Harley Quinn, what's her lane? She's just like a kid with no boundaries, you know, who just wants to have fun. And, oh, well, by the way, the most fun I can have is messing with Batman. So, like, we just make everything as simple as possible. And to do, you know, aliases, it's really tough to sort of explain what that is and how that works. So it even down to the point where on our show, even the location of the Batcave is not a secret.
Yeah.
Like the bad guys know where the Batcave is. They just know
that was literally the first thing I had to wrap my head around when I was looking at the writer's guys, like, wait. Everybody knows the Batcave is under Wayne Manor on a cliff outside of Gotham City. Like, everyone, okay, cool. I mean, but that's the thing. It's like the original ideas, like all the alias stuff in Batman is the least original stuff in Batman. It's from Zorro. Yeah. It's from the Scarlet Pimpernel. It's from the Shadow. It's lifted and lifted and lifted. And there's nothing wrong. I always enjoy a strong take. When you're rebooting something that has this idea in it that's 150 years old, if you go back to Scarlet Pimpernel, I think, or the, you know, the Robin Hood thing of your fighter for the common man always has to be a rich guy slumming it. It can't be an actual common man fighting for the common man because, ew, gross, which is something I've always kind of disliked about that genre. But it's like, I don't know if you've watched My Adventures with Superman.
Of course.
One of my favorite things about My Adventures with Superman is they just like, who are we trying to sell this show to? Young teens, young teen boys and girls. We cannot sell to young teen girls in 2024 that 6'2", gorgeously handsome Clark Kent is not attractive simply because he wears glasses. That was a cultural cliche in the 30s that you were homely if you wore glasses. That is not the culture we currently live in. And they just went, no, to any 12-year-old girl watching the show, if Lois Lane goes, ew, he's so gross, will go, are we talking about the same guy? That guy, that huge, handsome man with great manners is not attractive to a modern woman? Crazy bullshit. So I just love that they went, he meets Lois Lane and Lois Lane blushes and goes, oh my God, this guy is so cute. And it's like, thank you. That's a thing that shouldn't survive. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? That's a part of the original story that made sense in 1938. It does not make sense today. Drop it, kill it, lose it.
I mean, the whole idea of a secret identity in the age we live now, you know, in the age of influencers and constantly having the, you know, film where we are. And I mean, you know, when I did superheroes, when I did Banjax, that was where I started, is that, you know, I mean, one, it was not some principled, you know, billionaire who got the powers. It was the worst guy ever who was troubled and was going to have a hard time going through it. And it wasn't that he didn't want anybody to know who he was. It was, when, you know, when he became a hero, quote unquote, he wanted everyone to know who he was and went on every show and hung out with every girl and took everything that was offered to him, and it completely destroyed him, you know, and that was the interesting take on it. And, you know, you're obviously not going to, you know, go in that direction with a children's show, but it's but it is interesting. I think when we started doing superheroes, like you said, Avalone, we were in a very different time. It was a very different world. And we have, for whatever reason, held on to all of those old ideas. And so, and so we tell the stories now and we tell them in that old way. And there's something interesting and nostalgic about it. And I mean, you can ask the question, that way, and maybe that's an interesting exploration, but for the most part it's like, okay, but it is maybe more interesting, and certainly more interesting to a kid who has, like, you know, who will no will history. Not buy into bullshit, will be like, why are they doing that? That's stupid, that doesn't make sense to me. like they're not going to get caught up in it. They don't have any frame of reference for, you know, for old Superman or anything like that. And and that is so interesting to me. So it's like, so what do we owe them? And how are these things going to be, I guess, best consumed, is I think such an interesting question. Yeah.
I mean, you know, you owe it when you take on anything new, new to you, I should say, you know, a franchise, you always open the hood. And you go, why does this work? What parts of it still work? What parts of it are now obsolete and don't work anymore? And if you're smart, you make it run on what you learn from that experience. I mean, I've had to do that with every franchise, every licensed character I've written. You go, like, what if I loved this, what do I want from it that will give me the things that I love without it just being a collection of cliches and everything that's been done before? And that's, you know, I feel like that's job one as a writer, is to do the thing that everybody loves and do it in such a way that isn't a thing they've seen over and over and over and over again.
Well, but you're talking about for comics. I mean, I think when you're talking about TV and movies, people always, when they're doing an adaptation, almost always ask the wrong question. The first thing they do is they almost always say, well, what do I have to change about this to make it a TV show or a movie? Yep. When really the question should be, what is awesome about this that I have to make sure is in my TV show and my movie?
That's right.
They fail right away because they don't bring that thing that makes it.
And I would say that I identify the success of the Feige of it all, the Marvel universe, to the degree that it's been successful. And I think it's been largely extremely successful. That's not very controversial to say. But what I noticed was different about him is that when you get even the first Superman movie, which was great, it is not particularly based on a comic book. It's based on the aggregate of cultural memory of Superman. And it makes very strong, smart choices about Krypton, about Metropolis, about Lex Luthor, about all of those things. But you can't point to a comic book and say, oh, they're adapting this. When Feige gets the Marvel Universe off the ground, I think part of the genius is he does not hire a screenwriter to say, tell me what you think you would do with Iron Man. He goes, well, here's Iron Man's origin story, and here's the villain, the Ironmonger, and here's some good issues about that. Adapt that into a movie. My favorite thing about those movies, honestly, is that I think the Civil War run of Marvel Comics is terrible. I don't like it. I don't think it's good. The movie's great. Like, he took the basic idea of what is good about conflict between Steve Rogers and Tony Stark. That's a good idea buried in this very popular comic book, so we can use the title. But I'm not going to use any of the stuff that's in there, really. But that going back to the comic books and going, you know who's a great villain? Thanos. No one's heard of him. No one knows who it is. No movie audience. We're going to make this guy Darth Vader to a whole generation because Jim Starlin created one of the great indelible comic book characters of all time. As opposed to going, let's create an anti-Captain America character who's completely new, we like, let's invent supervillains for them. It's like, no, don't. You've got huge cast.
I'll also say visually, it's the same. I always called it, like, what they did with the Marvels was they started leaning into the tights again. You know, before that, you had like the X-Men movies and everyone's running around in leather because they were still just a little afraid of superheroes not being in our real world. Oh, like the Dark Knight movies, we're still a little, we better make it plausible. We better make it all like surplus military hardware. And oh, we'll even explain that the supervillains were created by some gas that got released in Arkham. Like they're just taking these pains to make it work in our modern world. When I think in the success of the early Marvel movies was like, okay, this is a superhero world.
Yeah, it's comic books, man.
We have supervillains, like it's comic books. And that was a huge...
No, and I really feel that, you know, looking at the trailers for Superman and Fantastic Four seem really like they went, no, man, it's comic books. We're making comic book movies here. This is some comic book shit. This is some Jack Kirby, Stan Lee shit we're going to give you in the Fantastic Four. And we're even going to make it a period film so we can really make it Jack Kirby and Stan Lee. Rather than trying to go like, I mean, that Rise of the Fantastic Four movie, they turned one of the great comic book characters of all time, Galactus. They made him V'ger. They made him a cloud instead of a 50-foot tall guy with a helmet with neat spikes coming out of it, like, you know, with fans. If you're afraid of that, don't even bother making a comic book movie, man. Like, you know, and honestly, I was going to say this before, but you know, a lot of people are down on the multiverse of it all, but there's a thing about it that I love, which is very much what you were saying about Spider-Verse, was that last live action Spider-Man movie they made. I wasn't crazy about all of it, but I love that the overall thing was your Spider-Man that you grew up with, valid. It's a real Spider-Man. Mm-hmm. That movie, like that whole movie was a hug for Andrew Garfield. No, man, it's okay. We're sorry the two movies you were in are bad and no one remembers them and no one cares about them. But you, buddy, you were great. You were fucking great.
He was great in that movie. Like you fell in love with him again. Like it was such an amazing showcase. I'm like, wow. Like he's great. Like what can I cast him in now? Like,
yeah, but that's the one thing I appreciate about the multiverse of it is the, your guy, totally the guy. You just run with that. You know, that's what you love. That's the version of this you're into. We're not trying to take it away from you. It's still completely valid. And I think that's hilarious and great.
It is. I just think they've now reached a point where, you know, the audience is so programmed to understand the patterns, the storytelling patterns that are way ahead of you. And it relates back to what I have to deal with, just making Batwheels for kids. I, you know, even though they're young kids, I feel like you get programmed to understand Western storytelling. And so like a kid may not be able to articulate it, but he can kind of sense like, oh, you know, it's the bottom of Act Two and the hero's up a tree and we better find a way to get him down, you know, by Act Three. And it's just a feeling. So I'm always trying to find ways to sort of change that up so that the audience won't be ahead of you and won't anticipate what they know is going to happen here. And I think, you know, whether we're talking Marvel, Star Wars, so many of these franchises, it's now so baked in that, you know, when you see like some giant facility in floating in the clouds in Act One, you know that you're going to see it blowing up in Act Three. And, wait, you know, this is the scene where the hero gets used to his powers and learns how to use them. And, you know, we know all these steps. And the advantage you guys have when you're doing comics is you don't have to tell that origin story every goddamn time over and over again. You can pick up, you can look at it, like you said, you know, do a forensic examination of what you love about it, you know, and have some fun there. You don't have to once again reinvent, which is so tiresome. I think even for non-comic fans, it's now tiresome.
Oh, absolutely. No, I don't think there's a person on this earth that needs to see Batman's origin story filmed ever again. I don't.
Yeah.
Like, and there are things, I'll say that I remember watching the reboot, the Superman, the animated series. And I was honestly moved by the destruction of Krypton sequence, partly because I was just like, this is no longer a comic book character origin story. This is a bedtime story. This is a fable. This is Moses in the bulrushes. This is, you know, this has mythic resonance. And it just watching it, I was like, this story of the destruction of Krypton and the coming to Earth and Kansas and the though I shouldn't say Kansas, it's only Kansas in the Superman movie. Did you know that? Richard Donner and his screenwriters, that's the first time we get the location of Smallville as being in Kansas. I've noticed that a lot of the TV shows, even ones I loved, like Lois and Superman, or Superman and Lois, they have to do this weird thing where Metropolis, which has always been New York City, is in Missouri, a half hour drive from Smallville. Somehow it's like, I don't know that Clark ever had to escape Smallville. If Smallville was an hour drive from the Daily Planet building, he could go see his parents on weekends, even if he couldn't fly. To me, it takes a lot of the power.
It's interesting. Part of what you're saying is interesting, that it's interesting to see what sticks, you know, when mm-hmm. someone redoes an origin story and adds something mm-hmm. iconic, like, you know, Frank Miller with the pearls coming off of Martha in yeah. Time Out. Like now everyone has to have the pearls. You know, it's like, if you create something that really resonates and sticks, it'll become part of that origin story permanently.
I'm trying to remember. I think it's, and this, I might be wrong, but I read this somewhere in my, when I researched it, it seemed correct. Christopher Lee is the first Dracula with pointy teeth. You never actually see, think about every picture you've ever seen of Bela Lugosi. I don't think he has pointy teeth in that movie.
It all
happens. Well, he's a different kind of mm-hmm. animal entirely. But Dracula doesn't actually have the pointed teeth and the going into the neck until you can actually show blood in the movie.
I'll one-up you on that. You know, if you know the novel Frankenstein really well, the most iconic scene that James Whale made so iconic, he's bringing this creation to life, electric, this and that, it all happens off screen in the book.
It's off camera,
sleeping upstairs in his room when the monster awakes, you know, and I remember rereading it not years later after and saying, what? Are you kidding me? Where's that scene? You know, hold on. And that's because it was so iconic. Part of that origin story.
I always think that one of the best screenplay adaptations ever from a novel is Goldfinger. And it's not one of the strongest books, which is probably why. But when I reread it about 10 years ago, I was shocked that James Bond does not see the girl painted gold. He hears about it in M's office. It is not a thing he viscerally experiences. He gets back to London and M is like, oh, they killed that girl you slept with. And I was like, oh, bummer. That sucks. And it's got no power. Like, it's a cool visual that the audience does not see. M just explains it to him. Oh, yeah, they painted her gold all over and they didn't leave a place for her skin to breathe, so she died. And I'm just like, as a writer, you go, how the hell did you come up with something so cool and macabre and fascinating, and you didn't want to write the scene?
Sure. Yeah.
You didn't want to work the plot in such a way that James Bond sees it and it changes him for the rest of the story.
It gets back to adaptations, like we were talking about. You know, the one that always gets me is there have been a number of adaptations of the great Richard Matheson's I Am Legend. Mm-hmm. And if you read the novella, you know, the best scene in the whole thing is, you know, if you know the story, you know, when someone dies in your family, the government orders you to take them to this big pit, and where you have to put them in there because this is, you know, otherwise the contagion is going to get around. And Neville's wife dies of the disease, and he goes to take her to put her in the pit, and he can't do it. He can't throw his wife in there in this communal bar. So he takes her to a graveyard and buries her. And then the next day shows up, and he gets a knock on the door, and it's his wife.
Yeah.
You know, she's back. And so how do you, as an adapter of that.
Yeah. How do you skip that scene?
How do you not have that scene in your movie?
Yeah. It's such a great fucking scene.
Great about this? Take what's great about it and put it in your movie or your TV show.
Well, and that's why The Thing is one of the great remakes. I don't know for a fact that they made the whole movie because of the blood test scene. But if you read the Joe Campbell story, and Joe Campbell, the blood test scene is also off camera. He's in another room listening to screaming and crying and whatever. So even in the story, he blew it. And then Howard Hawks blew it by not having that concept even in his movie. And then John Carpenter goes, no, man, that's the scariest thing I've ever heard in my life. Testing blood, and the blood might be alien. And I remember watching that movie, and the best thing you can do to an audience, everyone in that auditorium is thinking, but what's going to happen when he sticks the hot wire into the alien blood? Like, what is it? what is the reaction going to be? We all know there's going to be a reaction. We know all know it's going to be fucking crazy. But he makes you think about it for 5 minutes before it actually happens. And yeah, that whole thing of like, you know, like the laser in Goldfinger is a fucking silent movie sawmill in the book. He ties James Bond to the sawmill like it's a 1920s pot boiler.
The whole plan to steal the gold. In the book, he's actually going to try to transport all the gold away, which would take like 3 days.
I actually think that is the greatest moment in screenplay novelization of all time is James Bond doing the saying, you know, it would take 200 men 3 days to fill 5,000 trucks or whatever the thing is. And then Gert Frobe goes, oh, yeah, the plot of the book, we're not doing that. That's stupid. That doesn't make any sense. You couldn't possibly steal the gold in Fort Knox. That's crazy. I got a whole other thing planned that involves atomic bombs and macroeconomics, if you want me to explain it to you. And that's such a genius, ballsy thing to go, oh, the book? Nah, book's stupid. We're ignoring that part of the book. We took my name. We took Missy Galore's name.
You know. But we're including the things that are great about it.
Exactly.
Goldfinger himself, you know, and we're going to cast somebody who's totally memorable. And
the most radical one, I always think, you know, you should love the thing and care about it and care about what's great about it and whatever. The one time I have violated that is I've written 3 short Gulliver of Mars comics, and when they asked me to do it, I said to the end, you know, I will say this because the author's been dead 100 years, I said to the editor, this is a terrible book, and the character is an awful character. Basically, the author can't decide if he's writing a rollicking adventure novel or a Swiftian satire, so he tries to do both at the same time, with the result that the hero is a terrible person, who at the very end, literally, they capture the bad guys capture the princess in front of him. And he gets a way to go home back to Earth. And he goes, you know what? I'm just going to go back to Earth. You know, good luck with the whole princess planet saving. You know, it's like Flash Gordon getting on a rocket and leaving in the last 5 minutes of Flash Gordon while she's marrying Ming the Merciless. You know what? You people are a lot and I'm going home. So what I wrote, I said, can I do whatever I want? And they said, yeah, you can do whatever I want. So I wrote a story that's 20 years later and he's engaged in violent combat in World War I. Because he's obsessed with what a horrible coward he was in the book. You know, I was like, the only way I can make this good is make him regretful for the horrible, useless coward he is in the original book. And I know that if there were fans of the original book, they would be outraged with me, but no one is a fan of the book Gulliver of Mars. Certainly not more than 10 people in the continental United States have even read the thing. So, like, I was safe to do that. But that's it. I would rarely – that's the only time I've ever, like, I'm going to sort of violate my
– there's a long history of that, to be fair. Yeah. There's a long history of, like, cheap, bad novels like Jaws or other things that got elevated by the masters that took them over. You know, that does happen.
I had someone the other day to me telling me that the Godfather novel is a masterpiece, and I was like, oh, buddy. Yeah. Oh, buddy, there's great stuff in it. God knows, but that is a shitty book. You know, it's all due respect to Mario Puzo. There's a reason why, you know, you'd think that someone who had a big cess with The Godfather, see further Peter Benchley, there would have been 30 movies by Mario Puzo and by Peter Benchley. Somehow, it's just the one thing that we remember him from, because what came afterwards was that draft of the Superman screenplay where Mario had Superman mistake Kojak for Lex Luthor.
I thought Jurassic Park was a really interesting an interesting example, because what happened with Jurassic Park was I remember reading it before seeing the movie, and it was phenomenal. It was just, you know, the science in it, it was just a phenomenal book. And, you know, then the second book came out after the first movie, and the book was so influenced by the movie, the second Lost World. It's so much more fast paced, and the cutting, it cuts like a movie. And I was really kind of disappointed, because I just thought it fed off something that it isn't. You know, I wish it had stayed a novel in the same sense that it always was. But, you know, that
I also, I will say, I also have, I lose all respect for somebody. The books and the theory of the books, the premise of the books in its way is already a ripoff of Conan Doyle's Lost World. Don't then call the book The Lost World, man. That's like that's just really shitty. It's that would be literally like if the second issue of Batman was called The Shadow. It's like, no, come on. Don't just say, oh yeah, here's, you know, I guess everyone's forgotten The Lost World, so I'll call the second book The Lost World. And that, yeah, that just, when that was announced, I was like, what are you thinking? I know titles aren't copyrightable, but there's a certain, yeah, go out and write a novel called Star Wars and see how far that gets you. Like, you know, don't do it. We should probably wrap up. We usually end by saying, where can people find you? I know you're not a terribly online guy. You're not, you don't do the social medias very much, if at all.
You can find me on my show. You can find my show on Netflix and on Max, soon to be rechristened HBO Max.
Yes. And
I highly suggest any of you out there with little ones, they're going to love it.
You know what? And even if you don't have little ones, go to Netflix, start the first episode of Bat Reels, and leave the room for a day, and just do wonders for our numbers on streaming. Because God, I was over a friend's house recently, the Dillons, and they had Bat Wheels playing on a loop, and it made me very, 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 very happy because they have a couple of little ones. Ryland, what do you got going on, and where can people find you?
I am at Ryland Grant on all forms of social media. That is R-Y-L-E-N-D-G-R-A-N-T, if you're just listening. A lot of you are. I have to spell it because it's not a real name. My parents kind of drunkenly arranged letters and saddled me with it, so now I have to spell it for you. But yeah, the entire Ryland Grant comic book library is out there. Fine comic shops, Amazon, the whole nine yards. The campaign for the latest issue of my Fargo-esque crime drama, The Peacekeepers, just wrapped up on Kickstarter. We are taking late pledges. There will be a backer kit shop also. So, you can go and get everything there. I mean, the cool thing about it there is you get kind of, con exclusives and signed stuff, and it's kind of a one-stop Ryland Grant shop. So that is good. Couple of movies, that are out on the streamers now that are decidedly not for, your 8-year-old children. There is a State of Consciousness, which is a sci-fi mindfuck starring Emile Hirsch. More importantly, Haunted Heart, from Academy Award winning director Fernando Treva, starring Matt Dillon. Proud of that one. Go watch those. Play them a couple of times and leave the room, like Avalone said. I don't know. Maybe sit down and watch one of them. Maybe you'll get something from it. But keep the kids watching Bat Wheels in a different room.
I am easily Googled, but I would like you particularly to go to my Patreon and take a look at that. You can order your Bat Wheels ornament from Hallmark for next Christmas, by the way. We'd all love it if you did that. As I learned right before the broadcast, Dynamite made a deal with Lunar. So the last episode of this show, I told you that Red Sonja Noir was coming out in June. Now it's July 16th. So keep an eye open for that. And thanks for watching the Writer's Block. And Michael, thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, thank you for having me, man. It was great. A lot of fun.
Thanks, man. Good to talk to you.
If you're watching us on YouTube, be sure to smash that like button. If you're listening to us on Apple Podcasts or other fine purveyors of ear crack, please leave us a 5-star review. And wherever you're watching and or listening, subscribe, subscribe, subscribe. We'll see you back here next week for more Madcap hijinks on The Writer's Block.
For more information, visit pendantaudio.com. Thanks for listening.